Again for How About Netflix. I'm Connor.
And I'm Colin.
And Al once again has better things to do with his life than talk about bad shows and
One good show, but definitely not here to talk about one of the bad shows today.
So to keep things progressively increasing the quality of the show, we've decided to branch out today and discuss a couple of topics, which we did last week, and we're going to try continuing that. First up, of course, we couldn't have a show about streaming without talking about The Mandalorian. Mm-hmm. And I got to ask Colin, rewind to about 5 months ago, did you think that you would end 2019 being excited about anything Star Wars related?
No, to be honest, I think there was such an emphasis on the Rise of Skywalker and my very aggressive opinions on it. I thought that would overshadow everything. But no, The Mandalorian kept going. It just got better and better. And to the point where I actually thought it was funny that the Rise of Skywalker was built up as the last episode of the final Skywalker saga. It was even close to being the best thing Disney released for Star Wars that week.
And the thing that I love about The Mandalorian is that it is good for everything that Star Wars is not. We went through a whole season without ever hearing about the Jedi, the Sith. Nobody ever pulls it. You don't have the secret Force-sensitive character that pulls a lightsaber out of nowhere.
We
didn't get that expository background of who Baby Yoda is, and I guess that's something that's probably coming in the next season, presumably, but it gave us a cast of characters, and it kind of proved that you can have a slice of life story in Star Wars and have it be good.
That's actually one thing that a lot of people I disagree with, is that people talk about how there's not real arcing story, but I thought that was fine. I thought the whole idea they set up where it's just, you know, the bounty hunter, it's his daily life of, you know, missions that he goes on, stuff that he does, but then it becomes a, you know, for like a better term, adventures in babysitting. So that's just the extra factor to it. And honestly, I thought it was a really good idea, because, you know, we explored his daily life. We slowly got snippets of his past till we got the whole thing at the end. Characters he'd run into that he'd have you know, bonds for, or, you know, animosity, or, you know, things would come around. So I thought actually it worked well with the slice of life aspect.
Yeah, I thought it was great. There was no MacGuffin. You didn't have the ridiculous characters. The only problem that I had with it really was that Disney purposely delayed the finale for like 2 weeks to make sure that it didn't upstage the finale further. I wouldn't call it failing, but plummeting movie series. Yeah.
No, actually, I could be wrong, but I think what happened was, since they didn't want to have the same day as The Rise of Skywalker, I think they had Episode 7 of The Mandalorian the Wednesday before,
mm-hmm.
and then they had the went back to the regular schedule for the series finale, the season finale for Episode 8. Although, when you're so used to, like, week after week for a 40-minute show, those extra 2 days do go a long way.
And The Mandalorian... The Mandalorian came out at around the same time as Star Wars, The Jedi Fallen Order. And I gotta say, those two films have rekindled my interest in the Star Wars universe. It's kind of like back when they first started coming out with the new comic book and novels for the new Star Wars canon, where, you know, like they had... They had the Anakin and Obi-Wan stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had like Darth Vader, they had Lando, Chewbacca, and so some were better than others, some were subpar, but there was a period of like post-Force Awakens where the comics were, for me at least, the thing that I was like looking forward to, count down the days to get the trade paperbacks.
And even the lower end ones were still pretty good, because mm-hmm. they were telling the stories that we wanted to hear.
Yeah. Plus, I actually, and I know there's a lot of people who are canon versus legends, but I kind of thought it was a nice idea to start with a new slate, seeing, like, you know, the conflicts that Vader had after, like, episode 4, and, you know, knowing that it's, like, a new universe, for lack of a better term, be like, oh, we can do so much with these characters. The sequel trilogy, unfortunately, squandered that, like, to no end, but luckily we do have a few writers, and in the case of Mandalorian, Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni, who do care about these characters, and even if they are original characters, they know what to do, and they know how to make it feel authentically Star Wars.
Out of all the problems that that Disney has presented into the Star Wars universe, I think that formatting the extended universe and creating the legends versus the new stuff is just kind of, it's not a problem in the big picture. And it, because the extended universe had gotten so out there and crazy that, you know, Disney can pull in whatever they want from the extended universe and recanonize it. Like they've done theoretically with a few things, like Rise of Skywalker had a nod to Darth Revan, which may or may not recanonize the Knights of the Old Republic. There was a nod to Shadows of the Empire in The Force Awakens. But it's just more so for me, I like the fact that I can read a novel or a comic book and know for sure that the story was designed to be canon instead of during George Lucas's days, where he's just kind of like, yeah, write whatever you want. Just don't get within these timelines and we'll consider it canon unless I contradict it.
Yeah, because, you know, there's things like the new Jedi Order books where we had, I think it was like at least 5 writers. They wrote 20 books in the course of 4 years. I mean, if you got right into it at that time, that was, you know, something to look forward to. But if you got into it past its prime, there's, like, you know, so much stuff previous, like, you know,
there are thousands.
Yeah, like, you know, it's like, make sure you brush up on the Thrawn trilogy, the Dark Empire trilogy, the Jedi Academy trilogy, a couple, like, one-off books, and there's just a lot of build-up, and once again, it's like, if you were there at the beginning, it was easy to find that jumping on point, but if you just jumped into a Barnes & Noble in, like, 2011, that was overwhelming to know where to start.
So, to get back into The Mandalorian itself, The Mandalorian, it's a Clint Eastwood Star Wars series. Mm-hmm. You have the wonderfully acted Pedro Pascal as The Mandalorian, a.k.a. Din Djarin, which I don't really know if we needed to know his name.
Yeah, no, it's, the name itself went over my head. I just kind of kept on calling him the Mandalorian. I think I just had in my head, I'm like, oh, he's the Mandalorian, and just ran with that for...
Yeah, I think for most characters, he's going to just be known as Mando, which is what everyone in the show calls him. And then you have the child, a.k.a. Baby Yoda, who's the baby. The marketing opportunity for toys that Disney did not see coming.
Yeah. Although that's the thing is, I actually thought that was a benefit, because when it shows Baby Yoda at the very end of the first episode, it's actually like a genuine surprise, because we don't know what Yoda's species is actually called. So you know that Mando has stumbled across something special. And actually, like, the whole idea is that if Disney knew that this would be marketable, it would be like the Porgs, where it would just be like, you know, window dressing. But, you know, the Baby Yoda actually is like a pretty integral part of the show going forward.
And I have to say, I'm kind of surprised and a little bit proud of Disney for the way that they handled Baby Yoda. Because if you remember back when the new trilogy first started, there were pop figures of, like, Porgs and other characters from the show that came out
3.5 like, months before the actual movie came out.
And it was like 6 months before the movie came out.
Yeah,
because I remember that came out. It came out in December, right?
Yeah, I remember Force Friday was a big thing early September, but there was so much buildup going
like
into it.
July, seeing pop vinyl figures of Finn, Rey, Captain Phasma. because I was working at GameStop at the time, and people buy, and they're like, oh, I love Captain Phasma.
Actually, in your case, since you were working retail at that time, you actually saw the shipments come in. So, yes. And I imagine that with Star Wars, they wanted to make sure they were taking that seriously. So saw this way longer than most people.
People were buying Captain Phasma toys, and they're like, oh, I love Captain Phasma. Like, you have no idea who Captain Phasma is. All you know is that they're a stormtrooper with a name. And we didn't find out until months later that Captain Phasma was being played by Brienne of Tarr. And then they screwed up that whole character over two films. It's like, hey, we got this really cool, we have a cameo by a Game of Thrones actor. Everyone's favorite Game of Thrones actor. And what are we going to do? We're going to stick a helmet on her and make her whole purpose be to, you think she's dead, but she's not. And I'm honestly surprised. I want to say that J.J. Abrams, the plan when Rian Johnson killed Captain Phasma in The Rise of The Last Jedi was that she would be brought back in the third film of like, surprise, it's time for another dramatic fight sequence. And this time I'll actually be killed. But I think if that was the case, J.J. Abrams just like that's one of the things that was cut off from on the cut from the script day one.
Mm-hmm. But actually, I guess since we actually brought up Pedro Pascal, I think it's probably good to bring up other because everyone in this cast was like incredibly casted.
It has such a wonderful cast.
You know, Pascal was great as the Mandalorian. Carl Weathers, he was actually the real selling point for me because
Greef Karga.
Having Apollo Creed in Star Wars, that's enough to make me happy. Werner Herzog, who has like the perfect voice for the role he's in. Nick Nolte was actually surprisingly role casted. Gina Carano, who I guess like when the show started, I was like, oh, I'm not sure how I feel because usually we have like MMA fighters or wrestlers.
She was good.
For every Batista, you get a lot of canes or stuff like that. But she was good. She was a good lead. Had great chemistry.
I thought it was kind of disappointing that the show caught a lot of shit when she first showed up. Mm-hmm. Mostly in the let's call them incel portion of the Star Wars cast that are like, or Star Wars fans that are like, ew, a girl. How come she can fight better than the Mandalorian?
Yeah, there was a lot of, is she the new Rey? And luckily, since people enjoyed the Mandalorian, actually, most people just like, I think it just was swept under the rug after a couple days. But
they made the characters make sense. Like, the Mandalorian in the first few episodes of the show is not really a good, like, he has guns and he has devices. He's kind of like, he's like a more technologically focused Batman in that he's not really good at the hand-to-hand fighting. I mean, we see him in the first episode, he gets his ass kicked by a blarg.
Yeah, that's actually one thing that I liked. That was my first time. I was like, oh, I want to see what they're going to do with this character because, Jango Fett or Boba Fett, where they just kicked ass and they were just like the antagonist. But the idea of, seeing him actually not be good at everything the first time or not have the answers offhand actually set up like a lot of interesting, like, how's he going to get out of this or can he get out of this? And there's even like in the season finale, there was times when like he might actually die at this point because
I thought he was going to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think most people kind of figured like, oh, you know, he'll have like his taking off the helmet at a certain point in the show. But there was a period at the season finale where I was like, he might actually not make it out of this alive because it was a pretty serious predicament he was in at that point. Oh, actually, I just want to bring up the last great casting choice is Giancarlo Esposito as Moff Gideon. For people who don't know Giancarlo Esposito, he's the guy who played Gus Fring on Breaking Bad, who was actually, in my opinion, one of the best parts of the show. Now he's going to be this great antagonist, even though he shows up late on this. And also, he seems to be a prominent antagonist for The Boys. So this year is going to be Giancarlo Esposito's year. I cannot wait to see what he does with both shows.
I thought you were going to say Amy Sedaris.
Amy Sedaris was actually quite a surprise. It took me until after I watched that episode. Which, by the way, that episode she was in was, out of all the episodes, people seem to enjoy the show, but there's one episode that caught a lot of shit. That was actually the episode, surprisingly.
I've honestly stopped reading a lot of that stuff. Yeah. I don't... I've lost my patience for the consistently pissy demographic that just want to go online and complain about little things. And it's not coming from a place of consume product and then get excited for more product. It's the people who, like, when the with Cara Dune in the episode where she showed up and people were just looking for reasons to complain, and they're like, well, he took off his helmet too close to the window. Mandalorians don't do that in the lore. That's stupid. What were they thinking? Oh my god, the show is broken. They ruined everything.
Yeah, it's like the fans that people, like, you get people who always drudge up saying Star Wars fans are terrible, but it was really just that small group, and as long as you ignore them, just let them just say their thing, there's a lot to enjoy about the show. So there's, you know, so that fifth episode, I actually like quite a bit, and when it ended, I was like, oh, Dave Filoni directed this, he understands lore, he understands that don't fly too close to the sun with fan service. He wouldn't do it unless it felt organic to the story.
I had to pause episode 5 in order to look up the IMDb, because the whole time I was you could tell, because Amy Sedaris has a very distinct voice.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very distinct, like, usually constantly sarcastic, a little bit on the nasally side. And I looked it up, and I was like, this has got to be Amy Sedaris, but she looks so different.
Yeah, no, I guess.
And I looked up the pictures, and it's because she looks healthier than she normally does. She usually has kind of a gaunt, like, her. She did a Q&A for Strangers with Candy, and she said that she's typecast, forever typecast into the old junkie whore character position, and looking at the differences, it's because, like, her cheeks are more filled out and she looks healthier, and she doesn't look pale and sickly like she did in Strangers with Candy, which is pretty much what I know her from, because I've watched that show like 1,000 times.
Yeah, you look at, like, Stephen Colbert from Strangers with Candy, they look at him now and it's like, that's what you expect Stephen Colbert to look like 25 years later. But Amy Sedaris, the curly kind of hair wig she had, one, props to them making that look very distinctly 70s, but it made her look a little bit older, but not, like, old, like, from Stranger with Candy old.
She looks younger in this than she did in Strangers with Candy.
In 1995.
Yes. So, like I said, the greatest parts of The Mandalorian season 1 were the things that were not in the show, in my opinion. Things like you didn't have the Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where they, I don't know if you've ever played Dark Forces.
No, I know enough about the game, at least gameplay wise.
It was a great game. First mission of the game is you steal the plans for the Death Star. So they one-upped Rogue One with a one-man team where the guy survives like 25, 30 years before the film came out. But they kind of ruined it, because you play a mercenary, and in Dark Forces 2, that's when you find out that your character is Force-sensitive, and you get a lightsaber. And Dark Forces was fine without a lightsaber, but they put in a lightsaber because people would recognize it. And again, in here, there's no lightsaber, there's no Jedi. The people in the show don't even, like, Luke Skywalker is a myth.
Mm-hmm.
Darth Vader, it's a reminder in the canon of the show that, like, Darth Vader is a myth to most people. He's just kind of like this, he's almost like the boogeyman henchman of the Empire, because 99% of the galaxy has never seen him. They've never encountered him. They just hear stories of this tin man in a suit that can control things with his mind. The Force is a myth. It's an urban legend that people talk about and nobody really believes in.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the child, the Yoda, baby Yoda, that's 50 years old. Somehow, for some reason, still coos like a baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you have Yoda where he talks about how he started training at like Jedi for 800 years when he's 900 years old. So who knows? Maybe there's just one hell of a growth spurt in the next 50 years, or hell, maybe there's not a growth spurt within the season two of The Mandalorian.
Are we going to have to deal in season two with baby Yoda being teenage Yoda?
Oh, where he doesn't clean up like as part of the ship, and there's or maybe we'll get that scene in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, but it's Pedro Pascal and whoever would motion capture Teen Yoda.
Are we going to get that thing in season two where teenage Yoda, voiced by Vin Diesel, is being taught to not have the speech impediment?
Don't give them ideas, because now that Disney has something great on their hands, they're going to know, and I'm afraid that they're going to do something and screw it up, that there's going to be, this foreshadowing, by the way, if we're going to talk about later, that there's going to be a very committee mindset, and that too many people at Disney and Lucasfilm are going to like impose what to do to Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni. And I hope to God that doesn't happen, but that is a thing where I'm starting to think this is too good to be true. Like, you look at Stranger Things, where it had a perfect first season, and then seasons two and three, I still appreciate them, but I know there are serious missteps.
Just to continue, I'm just going to throw in one more. We're not going to have that scene in season two where teenage Yoda is like, get a date, I must. And then they take teenage Yoda to the dance.
Oh, like, is this going to be another Yoda species, or is this going to be a Twi'lek?
What I'm saying is that where season one was a Western space opera, season two of The Mandalorian is going to be Degrassi Junior High, but a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Oh, actually, that's also on the other end. Baby Yoda is just too much, like, it is, like, Baby Yoda's caused so much of a stir on the internet, they might just keep it as Baby Yoda.
Yeah, he's 50 years old and he's still in baby mode. He's got a long time to grow up. Mm-hmm. But how angry do you think that Kathleen Kennedy was and Rian Johnson upon seeing the initial reaction to The Mandalorian? Because just in that, like, 5-second scene where Baby Yoda appeared in the first episode, the internet was just like, they loved him. That's, from the moment they saw him.
Of all the things that subverted expectations for Star Wars fans, Baby Yoda is like high up on that list. There's actually a lot of moments in this season that subvert my expectations, but I don't think I could have been blindsided by anything as much as Baby Yoda. There's one thing I do want to talk about is Jon Favreau. And this is the difference between The Mandalorian and the sequel trilogy, is that George Lucas actually did like visit the set for The Mandalorian, and he did actually impart a few wise words for Jon Favreau, which Jon Favreau was kind of run with.
Was the advice, listen, Favreau, merchandise the shit out of that Baby Yoda.
You know, who knows, maybe Jon Favreau will come out and confirm something like that, but he was actually talking about like the mythology of Star Wars, what it means to him, not just the Force, but just the you know, the type of audience he was trying to go for. And you can tell that there's actually a love behind the show, that, like, you know, everyone who works on it in front of the camera and off camera are fans. And Rian Johnson and Kathleen Kennedy really should have kept that in mind before putting hundreds of millions of dollars into movies that divide audiences.
Yeah, they have to be pissed, because they kept throwing, like, we have female lead actor. A lot of people hate Rey. We have Finn. A lot of people hate Finn. Not even so much for what Finn is, but how they treated him in the movie. Because yeah. I liked the... I'm really not one of the people that jumps into the Mary Sue kind of conversation. They've been fucking with the Star Wars mythology for decades. Mm-hmm. Even when George Lucas had it, because they don't seem to understand when exactly you're supposed to start training to be a Jedi. Because, mm-hmm, I mean, right from the beginning, Luke trains to be a Jedi. as an adult, even though Yoda specifically, like, oh, he's too old.
No, that one I always accept because Luke's supposed to be 22, but it's really in the Phantom Menace one, Anakin's too old at 9 years old. Yeah. It's like, what, do you just, like, steal him from the womb? Is this, like, the First Order who just abducts babies? How early do you have to get these kids?
And I will say that I enjoyed The Last Jedi for... It was kind of like an outsider's view of the Star Wars universe. And you could kind of see Rian Johnson's view coming out in Luke's rant in the middle of the movie, where he kind of looks at the series and he's like, what good have the Jedi done for this world? You have the worst atrocities in the history of the Star Wars universe that are either allowed to happen because of the Jedi Order's ignorance or non-interventionist policies, or they're perpetrated by the Jedi Order themselves, either through active Jedi or through all of the Jedi that have a habit of going bad and turning to the dark side.
Yeah. No, actually, and I actually would have liked stuff like that if, one, Luke felt like Luke, but also... if there wasn't that active, raging contempt for what Star Wars was up until that point. Because there's stuff in that movie that I actually think would have worked, but they're just clearly... Because the thing is that J.J. Abrams is the type of guy where he has a lot of problems as definitely a writer and a director, but I feel like he likes Star Wars. Rian Johnson's just that guy who just wants to start shit with people and like bombard you with like pretentious knowledge about obscure films. So.
Yeah.
But luckily, coming back to Favreau and Filoni, we have people who have a lot of talent under their resume. Both have previously worked on Star Wars. I'm not sure if you know, but Jon Favreau was actually the voice of one of the Mandalorians on the Clone Wars. Actually a recurring character for a while.
Yes. And they have a very memorable theme song. The theme from Mandalorian honestly reminds me of the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Theme song, and that it sends chills up my spine when I hear it in the show, and it's when you hear it, you know that something's gonna happen.
It's kind of funny. I think that the music that stands out more so within the Star Wars era did not come from John Williams within the last 5 years, but rather I can't believe I forgot the name. It's actually hard to pronounce.
It came from Ludwig Göransson.
Yeah, I see the name all the time, but I always forget how to pronounce it. But he did. There's people that I've seen complain that the music feels out of place. I'm actually fine with it because they're trying to do something different with Star Wars as far as the tone and the atmosphere. I think the music complements it pretty well. So plus, if you just had someone trying to imitate John Williams, it would just feel like a John Williams imitation. So I'd rather them just do what they're currently doing rather than, you know, just trying to do that bombastic orchestral score every time.
Yes. And they keep the characters consistent throughout the episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, I'm referring to near the end of the season where in the seventh episode, where I kind of you know at the beginning of the episode that it's going to end with Baby Yoda getting kidnapped,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the whole rescue operation with the guild, and the whole time I was kind of screaming at my television. I'm like, no, don't trust them. They're gonna betray you. And then they try to betray him. The guy admits that they were going to betray him and just kill him and kill him and the kid.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing ends with the whole thing ends with this kind of cheesy dialogue of you have to, you know, you can't keep the thing with you forever, so you're gonna have to take it, figure out where it came from, and take it back to its planet.
And actually, that does that is actually one thing that I was thinking of when that happened was. How I don't think there'll be a radical departure, but how different the story will feel from season 2 onward, because now that he has a very specific mission. He's like, he's got to find this planet, and then once he does find this planet, if he does at all, how is he going to find these species? Is he going to find the family? I know you said you were worried about them getting caught up with stuff that's related to the Force of the Jedi, but once they get to that point, that's going to be unavoidable.
Yeah.
So, But I again, like, I do trust Filoni and Favreau because they understand who these characters are and what makes this universe resonate. So whatever they do, provided that no committee steps in, I think they'll do a fantastic job.
My fear of The Mandalorian is that this film, considering that it comes after Return of the Jedi, is eventually probably going to have to find its way into the greater Star Wars canon. Mm-hmm. So when I heard in the episode about them having to go to try to find the Yoda planet, if it exists, mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, it's going to be answering a question that has never been answered in the history of Star Wars. Like, one of the few remaining actual mysteries to never be addressed, mm-hmm. which is Yoda a species? What is the species and where do they come from? And what's the deal with their connection to the Force? And more so, why aren't there more of them in the series? Mm-hmm. And I hope it doesn't turn into a...
Yoda and Nadal did it at one point, and Baby Yoda's all that's left.
Well, there's that. I think that's the best thing that they could do. Because my fear is that they find the planet of the Yodas, and then it turns out that the Empire's, the client, Werner Herzog's tracker is still on Baby Yoda. Mm-hmm. And then you get that scene where an Empire ship shows up and blows the fucking planet up. Actually, and it's like, well, that's why there's no Yodas in the sequel trilogy, because they're all dead.
Actually, that's one thing is talking about the Empire is that I like how on one end, they're like this completely fractured group that, you know, on their own, they don't really pose too much of a threat. But when Moff Gideon shows up, like, even though they're a fractured group, you have that strategist who just knows how to make him threatening, because the Empire felt more threatening than anything I've seen in, like, any of the movies, like the sequel trilogy, Rogue One, Solo, you know, like the Death Troopers just shoot Werner Herzog, shoot the Stormtroopers, and they have this massive army. And I actually thought that last episode was actually just going to be Pedro Pascal, Gina Carano, Carl Weathers just sitting and just, like, waiting for shit to hit the fan. Because the Empire actually felt genuinely threatening under Moff Gideon at that point.
I like that aspect of the story because it serves as a reminder, and it's something that a lot of people criticized Return of the Jedi for. The fact that just because you destroyed the Death Star doesn't change the fact that there is an entire galaxy of just millions upon millions of stormtroopers.
Yeah.
And so you, in the greater continuity, I like the fact that the Mandalorian felt like it was existing in a changing world. Because, like, one of the first things that they deal with is the fact that the Mandalorian will not... the Mandalorian is offered, or he offers to pay in credits. Mm-hmm. And he offers to pay for something in credits. And the shopkeep's like, really? Imperial credits? Like, that's not good here anymore.
Actually, one
but,
other...
But it is a reminder that the Empire is fractured, but there's still a shitload of them out there. There's a lot of battalions of troops that could rain down fire upon a city.
Actually, this one didn't cross my mind until after the episode, but it's the fifth episode, the one I like, but some people may or may not have. But when the Mandalorian goes to Mos Eisley, he goes to the cantina, which I can see people would see like, oh, that's just fan service, but the thing is that you go in, the cantina is just dead, and it's run by droids, and the fact is that, you know, we go to New Hope, where they say, we don't serve their kind here. So it does show that, like, even the span of, like, 5 years, that there has been considerable changes, like, not just galactically or even locally within, like, Mos Eisley.
But it was, overall, the problems that I had with The Mandalorian were just so minor.
Yeah, no, I think if I only had any criticisms, is that, I guess, full disclosure, I always thought Jon Favreau as a pretty good director. Bro, everything I've seen, I've always liked but never loved. So the first couple episodes, I was like, yeah, this is good. You know, I'd like to check it out. But it wasn't until the third episode, actually it was directed by Deborah Chow, who I'll get to in a moment. That's the one that really hooked me and thought, okay, I'm actively interested. I gotta see how this plays out.
You should get to Deborah Chow now.
All right, so in the case of Deborah Chow, she directed the third episode, which was the one that I think kicked it into high gear for a lot of people, but she also directed the episode where they go on the New Republic ship to rescue the brother, the male Twi'lek. And the thing about her is that those are probably a couple of the best episodes of the season, apart from, like, the season finale. And the thing is that she's going to be a very prominent part of the Obi-Wan show. So I think that she's going to do a fantastic job with whatever she's given.
She is directing. She is listed as one of the directors on the Obi-Wan show.
Yeah, so...
Which still somehow still remains untitled.
Mm-hmm. No, I get this feeling they're going to wait till some, like, celebration or, like, a big Star Wars event to finally unveil, like, you know, what Ewan McGregor looks like, who else will be in it, the name, all these other factors.
Yep. All I know is that there have definitely been a lot of cancellations of Disney Plus since Star Wars The Mandalorian finished.
I believe it's projected to be nearly a quarter of its subscribers will be gone in the next 6 months. I heard 50 say that they're firmly sticking with it, but I don't think that's what they wanted. I don't think they wanted like a quarter of its subscribers to disappear, not even 2 months before like it launched.
I gotta wonder if Disney is working on kind of expediting some of the other shows that were supposed to come out, because there's a long gap between The Mandalorian and the other Star Wars shows, and even the Marvel shows.
Well, actually, the Clone Wars Season 7, that's coming out next month, and from what I understand, WandaVision was actually bumped up to this year, so I think they're just trying to do everything they can to hold people over, especially since The Mandalorian is the thing holding them over at this point, so... They have a bit of an uphill battle. Once the season 2 comes out, they'll be good. But from now until this November, it's going to be pretty tough for them to keep people interested.
Yep. But before we talk about the Letterkenny, I wanted to get into a bit that I had written for today. I ended up watching the first season of The Twilight Zone.
Oh, yes. You told me a little bit about it, but only, like, maybe a couple scenes, not full episodes.
It's very hit or miss, kind of like the old Twilight Zone. Mm-hmm. The thing that I really hated about it, there was only one episode that I really hated, and it was an episode titled Not All Men. And the episode premise is that a meteor shower rains down in a small town, and all of the men who come into contact with the meteor begin, they start getting violent and attacking each other and murdering each other on the street, and they get really rapey with the women. And the twist of the show is that the meteor is a placebo, and the men were just looking for reasons to get violent and kill each other because it's in their nature. And the premise of the title, Not All Men, is that there's one guy in the episode that doesn't get violent, and they ask him why at the end. He's like, oh, I just chose not to. So it's a premise of all men, and there's even a scene where the female lead, she takes the meteor because she wants to fight back. And she was like, oh, if I, you know, they all went crazy and violent and strong after they touched the meteor. So if I do it, it'll have the same. And it doesn't, because she's a woman and thus not able to be violent. And that's the premise of the show, is that all men are inherently scum and all women are inherently peaceful and not even capable of violence if they wanted to.
Was this episode written by Ryan Johnson?
No, the episode was written by Laura Dern.
Oh, well, Laura Dern at least has done other stuff that, like, acting wise. Oh yeah, and she didn't actually write that episode.
No.
Okay. No, but Laura Dern I actually like as an actress. So I guess at the end of the day, if you're just talented at what you do, I can heavily overlook stuff like that. But if you're someone like a Mark Wade, that's a whole nother story. Who also, speaking of which, Mark Waid completely fucked up the Princess Leia comic. That was one I actually made sure you didn't get, but yeah, that's as far as I'm going to go with my Star Wars talk for the day, though.
You censorious bastard. But I created, this started out as me writing my own version of the Twilight Zone episode, and it turned into the first bit in a series that I would like to call The Adventures of Kirk Cameron. And these are film pitches that I want to put forward because I want to bring Kirk Cameron back into the spotlight. He had a run for a few years making his movies, and he ended up going over to Flix, or Pure Flix.
I don't think he's a part of Pure Flix. I don't think Kirk Cameron's Saving Christmas. It's part of, it was something distributed by some weird culty church. I think it's heavily associated with them, but nothing from Pure Flix has got, though.
But the important part is that he's fallen out of the spotlight. Mm-hmm. He's kind of fallen. He's pretty much at, like, Hallmark Channel, direct-to-DVD.
It's funny you say that, because Candace Cameron, that's where she just gets her work. She does so many fucking Hallmark movies. It's, mm-hmm. like, it would make your head spin.
So the film, I wrote a film pitch in The Adventures of Kirk Cameron. And the film is titled Kirk Cameron's Big Gay Sunday. And it goes a little bit like this. Kevin Sorbo plays filmmaker Kirk Cameron at the height of his career. He has just launched the film Kirk Cameron Saving Christmas and decides to celebrate with a feast at where else but Denny's. Two grand slams later, and Kirk Cameron is full of eggs and hash browns and sausage and is ready to go home. He gets a call on the phone from the production studio. "What do you want? I'm full of hash browns and I'm ready to pray to Jesus and go to bed," says Kirk Cameron. On the other end of the phone is liberal film studio executive Socialism McBad Guy, played, of course, by Rebel Wilson. Rebel Wilson tells Kirk Cameron that his latest film did gangbusters at the box office, but they won't be able to work with him unless his next movie has a homosexual protagonist. "But I'm such a homophobe that I don't even wipe myself," says Cameron. "That's not how things work in 2019, says Rebel Wilson. "I'm giving you double the normal time to finish a script considering the circumstances. You have 24 hours. Kirk Cameron is in a pickle. He decides to mull it over with some dessert and picks up the menu to find a new Denny's item called the This Dessert Made Me Gay Sundae. It is a sundae bowl with malted chocolate ice cream drizzled with banana cream sauce and coated in rainbow sprinkles. Delicious. Kirk Cameron flags down the waiter and says, "Why did Denny's put this sundae on the menu, and why is it called that?" The waiter playfully winks at Kirk and says, "They put it on because it's 2019, and I was straight before I ate that sundae." We'll need to get a convincing Paul Lynn voice actor to play the waiter.
No, the only thing I'm thinking of is, like, does this sundae, even the midst of all the sprinkles, is it this giant banana? They have, like, the two ice cream scoops at the bottom on either side. I feel like that would really drive the point home. That would send Kirk Sorbo into a real, like, real tantrum.
Yes, and also there is constantly a rainbow overhead, over top of the sundae. So Kirk looks back at the menu and says, "Well, I do like the sound of malted chocolate ice cream. Sundae can't turn me gay. I'll have one of those, please, with a side of hash browns." The ice cream is just as delicious as it sounds, and Kirk Cameron goes home and writes a script about a gay man surviving in a post-apocalyptic United States where humanity has been wiped out by HIV after Congress bans heterosexuality. The film is titled Philadelphia 2, This Is the Future Liberals Want. Philadelphia 2, : This Is the Future Liberals Want. The next morning, Kirk Cameron wakes up feeling better than he has ever felt in his life, and he turns over in bed and clasps his hands up to his face like Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone and screams as who else is in bed with him but the waiter from Denny's. At this point, the audience is wondering if Kirk Cameron had gay sex with the waiter.
Oh, I actually just figured that was exactly what it was.
Which we explain at that moment by having the waiter wake up and say, "Boy, that was some great sex last night. And very gay, too." Kirk gets a call on his phone, and it's Rebel Wilson from the film agency. She says, "I got your draft, and I have to say, I love it. A reboot of Death Wish starring Melissa McCarthy avenging the murder of her husband. That's exactly what Hollywood's looking for." See, the best part of all of these film pitches is that I can see them doing all of this.
Yeah, if only we could get Kevin Sorbo, not even say it's Kirk Cameron, just get Kevin Sorbo on set to do this movie, and it would be the best thing he's done all decade. Well, early decade, but everything he's done the last 10 years.
Kirk Cameron immediately jumps out of bed and runs to the shower to clean himself off. He is confused as his life of believing gay people are icky is conflicting with him feeling better than ever after a night of sex with the Denny's waiter. When he comes out of the shower, the waiter is gone. An hour later, his wife comes home from work. His wife, of course, played by the ever-attractive Natalie Portman. As acclaimed actress Natalie Portman. She is already on the bed wearing the same bondage gear she wore in the Attack of the Clones film.
Oh, dear.
"Let's have some big sex," she says. And to his shock, now the thought of having sex with his wife makes Kirk Cameron sick. Kirk leaves and phones his best friend, Ben Chaperone, demanding that he run a story about Denny's new ice cream sundae turning straight men gay. Against his intention, the article leads to a flood of homophobic men flocking to Denny's to try this delicious new sundae, only for 90% of them to start having sex with other men. Only 90%. Gotta keep it realistic. The film time skips to 6 months later, the gay census is exploding out of control, and the birth rate is plummeting. YouTube now consists solely of videos where women post tutorials on how to convincingly pass as a twink in order to attract drunk men at a bar. 1 year after the epidemic begins, the Center for Disease Control releases an analysis of the Denny's ice cream sundae. The report states that the menu contains sugar, cream, malted powder, bananas, and artificial coloring for the sprinkles. The sundae was, Kirk says, "Oh my God, this is the twist of the film. The sundae was a placebo for closeted men, because we all know that homophobes are 90% closeted dudes who blame their actions on an uncontrollable outside force. And sexuality isn't exactly the binary system society assumed it to be." Kirk Cameron watches this report on television in shock as the camera pans out and into his bedroom, where Jordan Peele is laying under the covers to give his ending monologue.
And is this episode called "This is the Future Kirk Cameron Wants"?
Not necessarily. We need to get him on board for the film.
Well, let's get him or Kevin Sorbo. I don't know. That would give CBS all access the hit they need.
I mean, let's be honest. Who hasn't wanted to see a film where Kevin Sorbo plays Kirk Cameron?
I guess there's what movies has he done? He's done God's Not Dead, which he was actually surprisingly pretty good in. Everyone else is Hallmark level. He actually played it pretty well.
Don't forget Kevin Sorbo as Jan Van Sant as Pool Boy in Pool Boy Drowning Out the Fury.
Oh, that's actually the movie where I remember there's that scene when before the final act starts, when he has this little shrine of Jesus and he's talking to him about like the afterlife. I just thought, is this like Kevin Sorbo actually acting? Is this his beginnings of him becoming some evangelical weirdo?
No. It was long past that point.
And then, of course, there's the Jesus Bro movie where Kevin Sorbo wrote and directed Do You Believe? Or was it Do You Believe? He wrote and directed a movie which was literally Jesus Bro, but like the serious drama version of it.
Yes.
That one looked like a real trash fire.
Oh, yes. And moving from that back to things that actually happened... And keeping with the theme of this whole podcast being just an elaborate scheme for me to torture both of you and enjoy doing it. I subjected you last night to a little series called Little Kenny, the animated offshoot of Letterkenny.
Although I guess it's probably worth prefacing is that I was prepared for at least a day or two. You probably stumbled across it on Hulu or like on the internet and just were blindsided and just had to watch it at that moment.
I saw the promotion by Hulu's Twitter account and I was like, oh my god, this looks like garbage. I guess I'm going to go watch it.
All 18 minutes of it, all 5 episodes.
It's 18 minutes long, and the entire season took me probably an hour and 15 minutes to stomach my way through.
I was pretty much sent through all the way, but when I got to that last episode, I actually thought it was a much longer episode. I guess full disclosure, each episode is about 2 to 3 minutes. I thought there was like a 5 or 6 minute one. But I guess it's time to go in the details of, maybe not each individual episode, but at least go in the arching story and why the jokes just don't land.
Oh, there's not much to talk about as an individual episode thing, but it's 6 episodes that are split up between, 3 of the episodes are the iconic Letterkenny problems, and the other 3 episodes are basically origin stories. How Wayne met Derry, Derry's first super soft birthday, and how they met Squirrely Dan, which I don't even know how, if it's worth talking about how they fucked with the continuity, in the sense that Dan seems like he's a fair amount older than them in the main series, and yet he's a year younger than them in school. Never mind the fact that, like, Michelle Milet, who plays Katie in the show, Katie appears in Little Kenny. It's Wayne, Derry, Dan, and Katie as children.
They actually do have a teacher in it. I don't think it's voiced by anyone on the show, but there was at least one other actress who I imagine is incredibly embarrassed to be on the show. In fact, I'm convinced that everyone is embarrassed of this because it's not even listed on IMDb.
Yeah, the show, and that was, I actually didn't even notice that the teacher in the show is Miss Tricia, who may or may not be the same Professor Tricia that heads Squirrely Dan's women's class. But I don't think that I'm not sure if it's cleverly written enough to make that connection.
In all fairness, though, there's nothing cleverly written enough about this whole thing, because it is really just they're making baby voices and let's get really obnoxious stock bullies with like the most obnoxious flaps ever. And also,
I don't understand, because Jared Kiso wrote, produced, and voiced Wayne in that episode, and it's Nathan Dales and K. Trevor Wilson came back to do their characters. K. Trevor Wilson, by the way, has one line.
It might even just be one word. It's literally just
K. Trevor Wilson it's all those characters putting on really bad high pitched voices, stuttering, and having a lisp, because you know all children have lisps and stutter.
And I guess the other one that's worth mentioning is the animation quality, because the moment you showed me this, all I could think of was all like the shitty like revolving door of cartoons that were on like on a Wednesday afternoon on Fox Family in the late 90s.
Oh, it's terrible.
You know that stuff where you kind of remember, it's like, oh god, the Three Friends and Jerry. I forgot how terrible that animation looked. It kind of has that, but the things that Three Friends and Jerry was a shit show, but it was clearly geared towards like kids around that age. Little Kenny, on the other hand, has very weird, suspect jokes that are definitely not for kids, but too stupid for adults.
The show is definitely not for kids. It has swearing, incest jokes, talking about kids touching tubes. Wayne makes a joke about liking his aunt's milk jug hugs. It's stupid. It's like they recycled the worst jokes from the Letterkenny Problems shorts and threw them into this. And the show, it's like the show portion of it, the fourth and sixth episodes, where they try to have a story, but there's just nothing.
Yeah.
And I've never thought I could hate Jared Kiso's voice until I heard the two bullies, which I think are supposed to be like kid versions of the D-Gens, but just hearing them, they're like, oh yeah, oh yeah, we're gonna bully you, yeah, yeah. And they can't even keep the narrative in the show because this fourth episode is titled Derry's First Soft Birthday. And he's handing out flyers for his birthday while specifically telling people, it's like, oh, it's going to be the same birthday again.
I guess the...
You know my birthdays. They're well established with the unicorns, cupcakes, and stuff. And then the two bullies come up and every time they talk, I just want to become deaf and dead.
You know, and the thing about, like, Lil Kenny is that it could have just been this is just a shitty thing we can forget about. But I feel like it's almost, for like better term, a microcosm of everything that's wrong with Letterkenny from post-Valentine's Day onward. Because I think that this show was greenlit, over the summer, or was released in the summer?
The show, so Little Kenny came out in July on Crave, and Hulu didn't release it until December 27th. So the show, it actually came out the same day as season 8 in America. And the fact that Hulu didn't promote it until like January 3rd tells you all you need to know.
By the way, to put it in perspective, we're recording this as of Sunday, January 5th. So you actually discovered this before Hulu actually tried to promote it.
I discovered it on accident because I happened to see a tweet by Hulu talking about Little Kenny. I just happened to see it floating down my feed. But if you go on Hulu, you will find this nowhere. You have to specifically search it out. They're not featuring this thing for shit. It's made by a company. It's made by a production studio that makes trash. As I told you, they make literal shit animation. They created the tie-in commercial cartoons for the Poopies toy line because kids' toys these days have to be based around butts, farts, and shit.
But I guess
18 minutes. It took me an hour and 15 minutes to stomach through it the first time because I got to the end of the second episode and I was like, I need to do something else with my life.
Although I do wonder for everyone outside of Jared Kiso, Nathan Dales, I believe.
Nathan Dale, yeah.
Nathan Dale and Katra Wilson. You said specifically since Katie's in the show, but Michelle Milet doesn't voice her, that she was too ashamed, but I kind of wonder if there are characters like there's supposed to be like a mini Jonesy, mini Riley, or Stewart, Shorzy. If like there's like a lineup and they were just like, this is beneath me.
I'm sure, because they seem to be in a very, like, they're in second grade in the show. And Stewart, I want, like, the Skids and a lot of the other characters are a fair amount younger than Wade is.
I always thought they were at least the same age as Katie, who I thought was like kindergarten in it. So I kind of figured, I was like, maybe I'll just do like Wayne and Derry are the end.
I feel like they wanted to start it off with just probably just like the four of them.
Right.
And then on the deluded assumption that this would be a thing that people accepted, if a second season ever got made, introduce the baby Skids who are sugar addicts or something.
And then there's baby Glenn who like goes to Sunday school or something.
Yeah. Because Glenn, like some the other characters, like I picture Glenn as being older than Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
probably Mr. and Mrs. McMurray.
Although I guess it's all sort of...
Nobody wants to see that creepy-ass scene where you have kindergarten... Where the characters are like, ah, oh, kindergarten Bonnie McMurray.
Don't give them ideas, because in the event that this takes off and Letterkenny...
We all know that Jerry Kiso listens to this podcast.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, I guess so. I guess also it's probably worth coming back to, because this is also, almost effectively an epilogue of why I think Letterkenny is, at least to me, it's like this is like a nail in the coffin. Because, you know, obviously this was made by another studio, at least the animation was, but I was going through Letterkenny, the series itself, as far as, you know, people who directed, assistant directors, producers, and pretty much Jared Kiso and Jacob Tierney are just, they're kind of just figureheads at this point, because if you go at IMDb for the writing credits, they haven't had anything since 2018. Meanwhile, you at least have a couple people, like Trevor Risk, who has ran credits in 2019. As for production, Jacob Tierney and Jared Kiso are online for 2018, when there's people who are listed for 2019 as well. And then going into assistant directors, you can see this like massive influx for some people where it goes up to 2019. So this show, because the things that Jared Kiso, I don't think he would have signed this up for Hulu if he wasn't under the impression he had creative freedom, but they must have just snuck something in, because it just seems like the heart is starting to fade, the jokes aren't landing, there's like just bad sequences, padded like hockey sequences. There's just so much that's wrong with season 8 in particular.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and we watched season 8 not knowing that Little Kenny existed, and you could... Even at the end of us binge watching Letterkenny, it was very clearly, I mean, actually, we didn't even know that Little Kenny existed when we talked about Letterkenny a week ago.
Yeah.
And even then we kind of like, we laughed a lot at it, but there were a lot more pitfalls for that season. Yeah. And everyone kind of had this idea of like, there's something different.
Yeah.
Like season seven felt different, but it was still good.
Yeah.
And it was like season six was the roller coaster hitting the top, and season seven was, you could feel it moving forward towards the drop, and season eight is the drop, and it felt like something had happened in between those two points, between season seven and season eight, and now we know it's Little Kenny.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at the IMDb, presuming that it's up to date, showing that Jared Kiso hasn't done writing on the show, he's not credited as a writer in season 7 or season 8, and he wrote Little Kenny.
Yeah, no, I really do think there must be some weird obligations, because you can't be the biggest show by far on a Canadian streaming service and then have it just, like, you know, just remain something in their own control. Of course, like, Crave is going to demand something. Hulu's going to demand something. You know, all these people, they're going to get burned out on the momentum. I remember after season 7, I thought I had missteps, but I was still wanting to see what they do with season 8. But now I'm just thinking of what they could do with season 9 or a holiday episode even. I don't know. It's almost like an active dread for when those official dates are announced.
I'm going to ape Red Letter Media and just say, how does it feel having lived long enough to watch your favorite franchises burn to the ground?
Feels great. But no, of all the franchises last year, you know, you had Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. I love The Mandalorian, but The Rise of Skywalker is a real blemish. You had Season 8 of Game of Thrones. You had Terminator Dark Fate, X-Men Dark Phoenix. And then just, you know, and Avengers Endgame, which I also rather liked, but that feels like the end of an era. It just feels like all these franchises just are just, you know, ending, or they're just burning out. I did not think Letterkenny, of all things, would be on that list.
Yeah, I had my fears that Letterkenny would eventually be consumed by the great the great power that is media and the conglomeration of production studios. But I kind of hoped that we would get more of a warning in between.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of thought that the first Horseman of the Apocalypse would come in the form of a Letterkenny line of pop vinyls.
Yeah. And then
that's when you knew that the series was dead from a creative standpoint.
Because with season 7, I didn't dislike the crack an egg thing as much as other people. But there was like a couple distinct bomb jokes like, oh, they could just add that out. But no, I think they're just trying to pad it out because what else can, especially if Jared Keyes and Jacob Tiernan are working on it. You know, you have people who don't know this type of humor, don't care about this humor, probably in some cases. They're like, oh, let's just have a 5-minute hockey sequence. Like, humor be damned.
And you can tell, especially looking back on it, that there's different writers, because season 7 did what the show never really did before and had not just season-long major storylines, but storylines that went into the next season.
Mm-hmm.
It, like, you could pretty, for season 1 through 6, you could pretty much start any, you could watch any episode in pretty much any order, and you wouldn't be lost.
Yeah.
But, like, season 7 had the storyline with Wayne and Marie Fred. It had the storyline with Stuart and the city drug dealer,
mm-hmm.
which I completely forgot was, I forgot that was a thing that they left hanging. Like, when he's getting jacked in the first episode, I'm like, what's he getting ready for?
I actually thought that was, like, Tyler Johnson just, I don't know, maybe this is partially it, but I thought Tyler Johnson just, got jacked in between scenes, thought, oh, well, I gotta work this in the script.
He got yoked.
No, but I guess the
but
point
they had several running, Jonesy and Riley.
Oh, yeah.
With the whole Letterkenny Eagles thing. And that, for what Kraken Ag was as the weakest part of season 7, the constant news broadcasts.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. That
were also a sign, were my sign that, like, there's different voices,
yeah, the moment,
that have taken over the show.
The moment that season 8 started with that Sports Center thing, I was like, I just remember every other season before that, they had like 4 locations, they used them all to the best of their ability. And then they moved on. That was part of the charm of Letterkenny, is that they just had small locations, and then they just bounced, like, clever dialogue with each other.
They didn't even do the... Yeah. They seem to have thrown out a lot of traditions this year. There was no mid-season holiday episode, which they haven't... They started between season 2 and 3 and haven't skipped.
Yeah. There's the Valentine's Day episode, but again, that was
the previous.
Hulu, yeah.
That was from 6 to 7.
Oh, okay.
Because the season 7 aired in June,
mm-hmm.
and the Valentine's Day episode was in February,
yeah.
or March. So that was season 6 to 7. So 7 to 8 did not have a holiday.
Definitely didn't have a holiday.
They didn't have a holiday. Didn't have a holiday episode. They didn't have the opening of the season cold open that they have had every season since season 1,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of funny in a show that consistently repeats the phrase, you don't fuck with tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Also having a show about children when it's repeated that the main character doesn't really care for children.
Mm-hmm. But no, I guess now that little Kenny has been out to the public, I guess that those sort of our final thoughts on season 8 and where Letterkenny is at large, and
yeah,
why
Letterkenny season 8 salted my enjoyment of the show, and Little Kenny was like the notice of terminal illness of, like, pack your shit because this thing's gonna be going away soon.
No, I just hope that, you know, Jared Kiso, everyone, because the thing is that everyone on the show has always been talented, always had, like, good chemistry with each other. I just hope that, like, when you start seeing them file out one by one, that they land on their feet, find work that they enjoy, because they're all talented, and I want to see them do well.
Yeah.
But Letterkenny is just like a sinking ship for all of them.
I don't want to jump the gun and say that it is already a sinking ship, but season 7 was to give Titanic analogies, season 7 in my mind was the spotter seeing the iceberg. Little Kenny was hitting the iceberg, and now season 8 was starting to take on water. So we're at the, I think the show is at the point where it's in serious danger if Jared Kiso keeps allowing other hands to get their grubby mitts. And we'll, like I said, we'll know that it's in real danger once those Letterkenny pop vinyls come out.
Yep. Yeah, it's, who knows, maybe they'll be ready for season 9, but there will be a day where it'll be at GameStop and you're going to see Wayne, Katie, Squirrely Dan.
Shorzy.
Oh, God. I kind of wonder if, like, if that really is indicative of the show's quality, because the whole point of Shorty is that you never saw what it looks like. Hell, it was just seen his ass 3/4 of the time.
I had problems with seeing Shorty's full face in the 8th season.
Which is, like, clearly, like, Jared Kiso.
It's Jared Kiso in a wig.
Yeah, it's a wig, but also the whole, it's like a very transparent visor now, so it literally is just Jared Kiso.
Yeah. They didn't bother. They spent 8 seasons... or 7 seasons hiding his face and gradually revealing a little bit more of it to now just having a bad tinted visor.
And I kind of wonder, because you think of, what season was it where Shorzy's the referee? And they do this thing where he does this stupid but elaborate ice skating, like, out of frame. And you could tell that they took multiple takes to make sure that it looked good, and that Shorzy's face wasn't exposed.
Yeah.
But now it's just sort of like, meh, fuck it, he's on the ring.
Yeah. They don't seem to care about any of that stuff anymore.
Yeah. So
I mean, I'm going to enjoy it as long as it's still funny.
Yeah.
It's like season 8 was funny in a, there's, you laugh, but there's clearly something going on. Kind of way.
You get some episodes like Holy Sheet, which was actually a legitimately funny episode, but I feel like there's going to be a bit of diminishing returns, especially if Jacob Tierney and Jared Kiso don't have a part in it.
Oh, yeah. But on that note, I guess we're going to watch the Lighthouse for next week is probably the plan. Mm-hmm. But we had a good thing and a bad thing. Mandalorian, awesome. Yeah. Can't wait for season 2. Letterkenny, I am still excited for season 9. Maybe less so than I would have been.
Yeah.
Because you just know that fight scene that they set up at the end of the last season, there was no big season fight. And they've been ramping it up every season with more and more people getting involved. And it's just not there this time.
You get one fight
scene where Shorzy beats the shit out of JJFJJ.
Although, to be honest, that was actually a part that landed for me, because seeing Shorzy lose his shit was actually probably the best part of that episode. But for the season 8 finale, you had like 3/4 of like your entire cast showing up to this guy's house, and you cut it right before it shows any of them in frame with the guy that they're going to attack.
Evil. But granted, without it, there'd be a lot less to look forward to for season 9.
Mm-hmm. That's true, but I have this fear that with the writers who are not Tierney or Kiso, that's just going to be them back in Letterkenny with a time jump. I just get this feeling that they're just going to, if they're getting lazy enough to show Shorzy's face, they're going to get lazy enough to not do fight scenes at this point.
That's true. But on that note, I'm Connor.
And I'm Colin.
Good night, Danny Trejo.
Good night, Danny Trejo.
Feed Al those delicious tacos.
Maybe he'll come back. We need to do another Danny Trejo episode.
Yeah, we'll have to find something good on streaming with Danny Trejo. At least when he's not working on